WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Presidential campaigns nowadays are in part about selling the candidate's narrative. The McCain campaign has changed its narrative over and over, portraying the candidate as a fighter and maverick and as a bipartisan conciliator. Why and how the narrative has changed and how effective those changes have been is the subject of the article The Making and Remaking and Remaking of the Candidate by my guest Robert Draper. It was the cover story of Sunday's New York Times Magazine. It's based on interviews with senior and mid-level McCain advisors, as well as a number of his former senior aides. Draper is a correspondent for GQ and the author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. Robert Draper, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with just an overview of the different narratives that the McCain campaign has used.
Well, sure, Terry. I mean, let's start with the fact that John McCain is someone who America has known for a very long time and have only known Barack Obama, by contrast, for about 18 to 20 months or so. And yet what has happened over recent months is that Barack Obama has had one story and he stuck to it. That story is change. John McCain, though he's an individual we feel like we've known, has nonetheless had difficulty selling himself as a candidate as opposed to someone we should simply admire. And so what the campaign has attempted to do is find a storyline that that can connect to the needs of the electorate in this election year on a landscape that's very unfavorable to Republicans. So they have kind of toggled between these different qualities, these different characteristics of McCain. And none of them is invalid. They're all part of McCain. But in so doing, in emphasizing that the guy is, for example, a maverick the one minute and a postpartisan deal maker the next minute, it has achieved the nearly impossible, or one would have thought impossible, which is that this guy who we thought we knew so well has become unrecognizable to us throughout the campaign.
Well, I think some people feel he's become unrecognizable not just because of competing narratives that he used in the campaign, but because he's been so negative in the campaign. And that was something he always said he opposed, that kind of negative campaigning.
Well, and in fact, Terry, I think that's one of the narratives that I struck upon that sort of dropped into the campaign, not of the campaign's volition, but there it is, which is John McCain versus John McCain, that McCain has been running to some degree not only against Barack Obama, but against John McCain circa 2000, the guy who took down his negative ads in the very contentious South Carolina primary because, as he put it to one of his aides, he wanted to run a campaign that his daughters could be proud of. He often would say about George W. Bush's campaign, that's not honorable. What they've done is not honorable. The Jeremiah Wright matter, he said back in May or June of this year, was something that his campaign ads would not exploit. On the other hand, McCain has authorized ads, I think, of a very personal nature. It's not just simply that they attack Obama for being a flip-flopper or being inexperienced or being too liberal, but that they have also attacked his character, questioned his patriotism, suggested that those views that he espouses are not the views of ordinary Americans. And those play to fears rather than hopes. They don't appear to be honorable in the eyes of many and thus run counter to the narrative that we always believed was at the essence of John McCain.
Okay, so McCain was successful in convincing his strategist that he would not go with ads that tried to attack Obama through his relationship with his former pastor, Reverend Wright. But McCain did go with ads attacking Obama for knowing Bill Ayers and for having worked with him on a board of directors. What do you know about what happened inside the campaign in terms of how to use Bill Ayers against Obama?
Well, Terry, I think that in a lot of ways, Bill Ayers became a release valve for McCain and his staffers as a result of the constraints that McCain had put on them about Jeremiah Wright. I think that McCain felt bound by his word on Jeremiah, right? He had given his word, and McCain does not go back on his word. And that's where he drew a line. Well, he didn't give his word about Bill Ayers. And so in a way, that became kind of the release valve, and a disproportionality occurred using Ayers in a way that they were unable to use Jeremiah, right? I think that they felt that this was a legitimate issue, and I heard this all the way up until the end of my reporting from Steve Schmidt and others, that absolutely this reflected on Barack Obama's judgment and on his honesty, that he would hang out with somebody whose views were reprehensible and would not come clean about the extent of his involvement with it. And they believe that those are themes that, if anything, they were hammering on too late in the game and that should have been hammered on earlier.
You said that one of the narratives that has emerged unintentionally in the McCain campaign is McCain versus McCain, the McCain who is opposed to negative campaigning and the McCain who has been doing those kinds of negative ads. I wonder how much you know about why McCain decided to bring Steve Schmidt into his campaign over the summer. I mean, Steve Schmidt is known for negative campaigning. He worked with Karl Rove. So if you bring in Steve Schmidt, that's what you're signing up for, isn't it?
Not necessarily. And I think that it has been overplayed, Terry, the relationship between Steve Schmidt and Karl Rove. Schmidt had been a Republican operative for a dozen years before he ever worked for Rove. And his more direct superior was Ken Melman, who is not the slasher that Rove is. Melman is an organizational genius, a real disciplined fellow. And I think that that's what McCain believed he was getting with Schmidt. Now, it's worth backing up a little bit here, talking about Steve Schmidt. Schmidt was just one of many consultants, many strategists that McCain had in the summer of 2007 when his campaign kind of blew apart due to problems in fundraising, infighting, and an unpopular stance that McCain had made on immigration. And a lot of people left. Schmidt stuck around. He began to earn McCain's trust and began to tell McCain that, look, the press has written this off. We've already lost, but there's a lot of time on the clock. So I think that we can fashion a comeback narrative, and we have time in which to do so. But now we need to discuss the means by which that can occur. One of them is to focus our resources on New Hampshire, a state you're very familiar with. Another is to examine what it is that you're saying. Now, McCain back then had been talking incessantly about Iraq, and it was really driving a lot of people in his campaign nuts. They just thought, people don't want to hear about Iraq. They have war fatigue. Talk about the economy. Please talk about anything else. But Schmidt began to realize over time that McCain's refusal to turn his back on the surge was a plus for McCain, was in fact not impeding the narrative, it was the narative, and this planted the seeds for the No Surrender Tour that I think was the beginning of McCain's comeback.
One of the turning points in the McCain campaign was the decision to go with the Obama is a Celebrity ad. And this was after Obama returns from this incredibly successful tour of Europe and the Middle East, you know, tens of thousands of people showing up to his rallies. What went on in the McCain campaign when they saw how successful this Obama tour had been?
At this point, Terry, and we're talking about August, really just a couple of months ago, seems like a few years ago.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. The McCain campaign still had not developed much traction in terms of how to define Barack Obama. And they were very demoralized by the fact that Obama was out there getting basically round-the-clock coverage as he was on his tour of the Middle East and of Europe. So there was a meeting that took place among the chief strategists of the McCain campaign in Phoenix at the Ritz-Carlton in August of this year. And Steve Schmidt sort of opened it by saying, let me just throw a few things on the table for observation. Would anyone disagree with the premise that we are not winning this campaign? No one disagreed. And he said, you know, would people disagree with the premise that Obama is right now having his way with us, that he's got the media at his feet? And Schmidt, at a certain point, kind of had this, you know, epiphany and said, you know, they're treating him like he's a celebrity. And this sort of euphoria began to overtake the group, and they began to play with this notion of Obama as this ephemeral character. Now, this is important because they had recognized one flaw to the Hillary Clinton campaign against Obama, and that was that she was downplaying him as a mere espouser of rhetoric. The McCain people believed that words do matter, that there was something admirable about Obama and his oratorical skills. So the trick was not so much to suggest that words mean nothing, but the trick was to kind of push him up even further. As one of McCain's advisors would tell me, make it an Icarus thing, sort of push him up to where there's no oxygen and make a rock star celebrity out of him. And so this celebrity ad campaign resulted, and they did a major ad buy and comparing Obama to Britney Spears, and it really took hold.
Another strategy that they had in the McCain campaign was to make McCain seem like he was definitely the candidate of the two who had the international experience. And when Russia invaded Georgia, this was their opportunity because, you know, McCain knew the president of Georgia. So did they think their strategy was effective in trying to build McCain's international leadership capabilities around the Georgia story?
Well, it had mixed results, to say the least, Terry, and I imagine we will get in a minute or two to the matter of how the experience argument, the experience narrative, was undercut somewhat by his vice presidential selection. But after they did the sort of celebrity thing, they began to argue that McCain was the most experienced hand in a dangerous world. The Georgia matter dropped into their lap, they believed, presenting them with an opportunity to showcase McCain's foreign policy experience. Unfortunately, after Russia invaded Georgia, McCain went out there to give a talk on the subject and mispronounced Saakashvili's name, the Georgia leader, on two, maybe three occasions. And this was a guy he supposedly knew and yet could not pronounce his name. What they did then the next day when McCain had a town hall meeting was have these town hall meetings that McCain is famous for, that he's been doing since 1999, are very freewheeling, and McCain has a microphone and he's wandering around in front of the audience and speaking off the cuff, and that's sort of the charm to them. There's this kind of reckless quality to them. But McCain opened this particular town hall meeting by talking about the Georgia situation, and rather than kind of give these off-the-cuff remarks about Georgia versus Russia, as Russia has a way of demonstrating his superior knowledge, he read from prepared notes that were at a lectern that he stood beside. And it clearly, as a visual, undercut the notion of this guy who you could wake up at 3 a.m. and would know exactly what to do about Georgia. He was reading from notes just like any of us would. And so what that was about, of course, was Steve Schmidt exerting message discipline because he felt like it had been lacking the day before. And this, by contrast, was a rehearsed to a fault McCain and ultimately undercut the narrative of the guy who was the more experienced hand.
My guest is Robert Draper. We're talking about his New York Times Magazine cover story, The Making and Remaking and Remaking of the Candidate. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Robert Draper, and he has the cover story in this week's New York Times Magazine. It's called The Making and Remaking and Remaking of the Candidate, and it's about the John McCain campaign and the different narratives that they've tried in creating a strategy and a narrative theme for him. Before we talk about how Palin changed the narrative of the McCain campaign, can you tell us a little bit about what you know about why she was chosen in the first place? Whose decision was it within the McCain campaign to go with Palin?
Sure. Well, it's ultimately it was John McCain's decision, but it was by no means John McCain's idea. That's the bottom line. The idea to pick Palin came from Steve Schmidt and really principally Rick Davis, the campaign manager. Davis and McCain had met Palin at the National Governors Association convention in Washington, D.C. in February of this year. And it was a brief meeting, but it had an impact on Davis because Davis believed that she was, as someone who had sort of pushed through the Ted Stevens, Murkowski network of Alaska, could bring McCain back to his maverick narrative. And so Davis began to gather information, interviews and such about Palin and pass them on to Steve Schmidt. Schmidt was of the view, along with Davis, that this was a very, very unfavorable landscape for Republicans, and any Republican candidate was going to have a tough time beating any Democratic candidate this year. And when in doubt, it was better to go bold. I think their greatest fear would be that the game would be over on November the 4th. They would wake up on November the 5th and look at the playbook and say, we only used half of it. We never threw the ball downfield. We never did our trick plays. There were so many different ways to win, and we just played conservative football. And Palin fit the description of a bold move. And so as a result of that, they were the guys who came to McCain in late August of this year and advised him very strongly to consider her.
Did you get a sense about whether there were any regrets within the McCain campaign about the choice of Sarah Palin?
If so, Terry, it's the hate that dare not speak its name. but yes, sure. There's plenty of recognition inside the camp that there are other picks available that could have advanced the ball. Obviously, they didn't know that the financial markets crisis would occur and would really change the whole language of this campaign, such that the notion of pork barrel spending and getting rid of the good old boy network would take a back seat to, you know, having a steady hand and understanding about the fundamentals of our economy, which McCain has said are strong. If they had known that, then they might well have gone with New York Mayor Bloomberg, who was very high on the list of consideration. They might well have gone with Mitt Romney, who's known for his understanding of the economy, of economic issues. But they didn't. And so they realized that there's not much point in second guessing. At the same time, there have been so many melodramas that have consumed the campaign related to Governor Palin and the $150,000 that have been spent on clothes and makeup, the use of a voice coach, as I disclosed in my story, that make her look to be somewhat less than an authentic hockey mom. This is the kind of stuff that they could do without in the waning weeks of the campaign.
So after Palin was chosen as John McCain's running mate, they did the whole maverick thing. That was the theme of the campaign for a while. When did the McCain campaign start to downplay the maverick idea? Was there a point that they thought it's not really catching on?
Yeah, so the moment that the financial markets collapsed, you know, at this time of incredible instability, that what we really needed right now was somebody to go in and shake things up. What we needed was for somebody to come in and calm things down, for somebody to bring people to the table. And so McCain made this decision to suspend the campaign, to go all in, as it were, and to go back to Washington and forge a bipartisan consensus. But leaving aside whether or not that narrative played out, it really didn't, that narrative ran counter to the notion of someone who would take a wrecking ball to Washington, D.C., which essentially was what McCain and Sarah Palin were promising they would do.
So take us behind the scenes there during that moment when McCain decides to suspend his campaign and go to Washington with the idea that he would be a key figure in brokering a deal for the financial bailout plan.
Sure.
Why did they decide that he would suspend his campaign and try to be a key player in that?
Well, the notion, I mean, again, the predicate for all this, Terry, is this belief held by Steve Schmidt, Rick Davis, and others that you've got to be bold. When the economic meltdown occurred, McCain happened to be in New York a few days after it, and he had this meeting with his political strategist. It immediately followed a meeting he'd had with economic advisors who had told him that this was a true crisis and that if it were not addressed, there would be disastrous consequences worldwide. He had also been talking to House Republican members who had said, we're not going to go along with Secretary of the Treasury Paulson's proposal, the $700 billion rescue package. And so McCain sat with his political strategist for several hours and discussed options. The options presented to McCain were either to just sort of hold the bailout package at arm's length and the sort of view it with suspicion, or to continue to discuss his principles, continue to talk about what he thought would be the right thing to do, but do it while on the campaign trail, or shut down the campaign altogether and go in and sort of lead the effort to forge a consensus and get a rescue signed by the president. They elected the latter proposal, and what I've just described to you, Terry, runs absolutely counter to what the campaign was telling us happened. They were telling us that this was McCain's decision and his alone, that sort of the classic throw the dice Navy flyboy was, you know, conducting this bold move. But in fact, it was very much as a result of a discussion with political advisors that was carried on for hours. And to me, what's kind of remarkable about it is that they eliminated out of hand the middle course, which would have been to discuss all of this while continuing continuing to campaign. And that's what Obama did. That's what a lot of people, I think, would have advised doing. But they believed that it would be tantamount to walking and chewing gum at the same time, which for some reason they thought McCain incapable of doing. And I think it proved to be a very, very consequential decision.
McCain seemed to almost sit on the sidelines, though, during the discussions about what to do with the bailout plan. So if he went down there to make a bold move and suspended the campaign in order to do it, why didn't he take a more active part in trying to negotiate agreement on a plan?
Well, here's the problem, Terry. There were a lot of nuanced things at work. I mean, I've had McCain's people say to me, look, you know, you wrote this book about President Bush, and so you understand that their legislative team sometimes oversells things. They made it sound like this was a package that Congress would go for. In fact, they weren't going for it. There was a lot of protracted negotiation that was going to take place, and McCain needed to sit there and listen to it all. The problem is that essentially McCain's people challenged, you know, invited the media and the outside world, follow John McCain and watch the guy be a leader. They promised this sort of visual performance of this guy coming into Washington, going into this White House meeting with President Bush and Barack Obama and others, and him very demonstrably leading us toward a solution. But there was no kind of visual evidence of McCain doing that. In fact, somewhat to the opposite. McCain at this was supposed to suspend his campaign and immediately go back to Washington. He didn't do so. He stuck around and gave an interview to Katie Couric, then the next morning gave a speech at Bill Clinton's Global Initiative, and only then went to the Capitol and kind of hung out in his office for most of the afternoon, then went to a White House meeting where Barack Obama dominated the discussion and McCain said almost nothing. And so the McCain campaign was sort of promising us, you know, watch us, just watch this man perform, and the performance left a lot to be desired.
Robert Draper will be back in the second half of the show. His article, The Making and Remaking of the Candidate, was the cover story of Sunday's New York Times Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Robert Draper. He wrote Sunday's New York Times Magazine cover story, The Making and Remaking of the Candidate. It's about why and how the McCain campaign has kept changing its central narrative. Draper is also the author of the book Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. The narrative theme of the campaign lately has seemed to revolve largely around Joe the Plumber.
Yeah.
This was somebody who questioned Obama about what would happen to the business he was planning to buy. And then, you know, McCain kind of took this whole thing as his own. And even after the press discovered that Joe isn't a licensed plumber, that Joe doesn't have nearly the amount of money it would take to actually buy this business, that he was nowhere near ready to buy the business, and that it was unlikely that if he did buy the business, it would make more than $250,000 in profits, and he would pay less taxes under the Obama plan than the McCain plan. So since all this information is out there and on the table, courtesy of the press, why are they still going with Joe the plumber?
Well, for reasons you just outlined, Terry, Joe the Plumber, as an actual spokesperson, has his limits. But symbolically, the McCain campaign believes that he can be potent. You've seen this now in this ad they've been airing, I'm Joe the Plumber, where they show these various individuals who look like ordinary Americans who are concerned about what kind of America there would be under an Obama administration, an America in which there'd be this redistributing of the wealth where people's hard-earned money would be taken away from them. You know, it's a rather old argument to tax and spend liberal, but they think it may have some traction with independents. I think the second reason also is that they've kind of run out of narrative options, Terry. I mean, this is they've gone through five or six of these, and this is basically McCain the fighter who will fight for ordinary Americans. It's kind of a throwback to their very first narrative of McCain the fighter fighting on behalf of the troop surge. But it's a little late for them to come up with a final iteration and a new storyline, and so they're sort of sticking to this one, hoping that it will galvanize independents. It strikes me as a pretty ineffective one because I'm just not sure the tax and spend argument works as well on this economic landscape, and that the McCain campaign has hitched itself to this wagon and done so late at the game, I think is providing challenges for them. But I also think that they've really have run out of other narrative options.
But they're not calling Obama a tax and spend liberal. They're calling him a socialist.
That's right. Yeah, what this again goes to is this notion that the McCain campaign has promulgated for a while, which is you don't really know this man. And what gives the lie to it, Terry, is that Americans have actually seen Obama for a very long time now. He's participated in something like 24 televised debates. They watched in particular his performance in his three debates with McCain. They really have a pretty good sense of him. And a lot of people don't like him. They may not like him for policy reasons, for ideological reasons. Some may not like him for racial reasons. But they do have a sense that they know him. And this argument that you don't really know this man, he's going to pull a bait and switch on you, I think sort of goes against the grain of the reality that Obama's narrative is and has been set for a very long time. And so describing him now as a socialist, it more plays into the counter-narrative that Obama's been running against McCain, which is that this guy is, these guys are melodramatic, that they're a little bit erratic. They're prone to these sort of acts of flamboyance, going over the top and suspending a campaign, insisting that the debate be postponed, and now calling Obama a socialist. You know, sort of what's next? And at a time when we have two wars to wage and we have a bona fide economic crisis, these acts of shrillness and melodrama, I think, are not playing very well with the electorate.
One of the McCain campaign aides has said recently that Palin is going rogue, that she's now in it for herself in case McCain loses, and that she's saying things that aren't official talking points, that the campaign doesn't want her to say, that she's behaving like a diva. Have you heard anything like that coming from within the McCain campaign?
I have, yes, and I've heard as well expressions from the McCain campaign that Palin has been disloyal, which is about the worst thing that you can do to John McCain, be disloyal towards him, that she has veered off of talking points, that she's indicated that McCain has the wrong policy views, made the wrong campaign decisions, pulling their ad resources out of Michigan, for example, not talking about Jeremiah Wright. And I haven't heard that she's viewed as a diva, but that she's gone a little bit off the reservation. And they don't like that. Now, on the other side of the coin, I've heard from some people in the Palin camp that she has been very frustrated by the way that she has been stage managed. And there had been concerns from some McCain campaign people from the start that she was being overmanaged by people. Going all the way back to the days leading up to her convention speech, she was being coached to answer questions very, very carefully. And I have some sympathy for those people who were stage managing her, because they could see an individual who just didn't know that much about international affairs. And letting Sarah be Sarah might not necessarily be a good thing, as one of the McCain senior advisor said to me. But this was the balancing act that they have not quite achieved successfully, which is to keep her from making a fool out of the McCain campaign, while at the same time giving her enough oxygen, enough space to have a kind of a recognizable persona. I think it's been very frustrating for Palin and her supporters, very frustrating for McCain, and I think, you know, sort of goes to the capriciousness of having picked her to begin with.
During the 2000 campaign, McCain was known for, you know, the so-called Straight Talk Express, where he, on his bus, used to talk a lot with the press. You say that really changed during this campaign when Steve Schmidt took over the campaign. And we've seen that McCain's access to the press has been very limited during this campaign. Palin's has been very, very limited. You weren't able to speak to either of them for your article. Why did Schmidt think that McCain had to keep his distance from the press in the way that he didn't during the 2000 campaign?
Well, he wasn't there at the 2000 campaign, but his belief was, look, and he indicated this to Senator McCain, was, look, Senator, the press may have loved you in 2000 when you were this maverick running against Bush, but you would have found, had you been the nominee, that the love would have been short-lived. That basically, the press is liberal and they will turn against you. And Schmidt's view has been, this is nothing to be bitter about. It's just simply a fact. It's like, you know, no point shaking your fist at the rain. Rain occurs. The media is liberal. And ultimately, particularly today's media and Steve Schmidt's view are these sort of very young, Harvard-educated, blog-obsessed kids who are all going to vote for Obama, and you just can't expect them to be on your side. So at a certain point, you're going to have to draw the curtain. But I think even Schmidt was unprepared for the degree to which, in his and Mark Salter's view, the media really gave Obama a pass and did not investigate Obama with the rigor that they would have hoped. They talked to me a lot about this notion that Obama has never paid a price from his own party for bucking his party, that whenever he's done something against his party, it's never been a controversial move, where McCain has, as they love to say, the scars to prove for bucking President Bush and the Republican Party, nearly lost his candidacy due to immigration. And they wanted to see the media really pursue this, really kind of buy the narrative and take it and run with it, that Obama is not who he says he is, that this guy is just sort of a classic Democrat and will never really be this bipartisan problem solver. That the media failed to promulgate that particular narrative was proof to Schmidt, further proof, that that the media was not on McCain's side, was in fact against him, and that they ought to conduct their messaging accordingly.
One more question. You wrote a book called Dead Certain about the Bush presidency, and you wanted it to be a non-judgmental narrative, just kind of recording what happened during his presidency. And of course, he won that presidency by defeating McCain in the primary in 2000. I mean, that's one of the ways he won. So as President Bush is ready to depart the White House, and as we see McCain trying to distance himself from George W. Bush, I wonder if you have any thoughts you'd like to leave us with about surprises in the Bush-McCain Sure. relationship, or surprises for you in watching the terms in which President George W. Bush is leaving the White House.
Well, I was talking earlier, Terry, about McCain's performance during the financial meltdown. By contrast, you have George W. Bush's performance, which in September of 2008 looked very much like what most Americans had expected to see of George W. Bush in January 2001. That is, of the guy who was, as he promised on the campaign trail, a uniter, not a divider. That turned out really not to be the case. We're more of a divided nation than we were before Bush took office. He certainly said to me, while interviewing him for my book, that he's a results-oriented kind of guy, that he didn't care much for process, that it really wasn't ultimately that important to him whether he brought lots of people on board, just that he got results. But by 2008, with his power greatly diminished, we finally began to see the George W. Bush that I saw of him when he was governor of my state of Texas, who was a constitutionally weak governor and therefore worked hard with the Democrats in both the House and the Senate to forge bipartisan consensus and get things done. You know, this was basically Bush's approach in August of 2008, that, Secretary Paulson has a proposal, but the important thing is that we respond to this crisis, and I'm really interested in what everybody's got to say. And what we saw was a very, very conciliatory White House, of course, you know, ultimately because of the lame duck status. But it does kind of leave, you know, I think a lot of people wistful, seeing, you know, Bush, frankly, perform admirably during that, and leaving us with a question of what might have been had Bush been in from 2001 all the way up until the present, the man that he promised that he would be when he ran for president.
Robert Draper, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Terry.
Robert Draper's article, "The Making and Remaking and Remaking of the Candidate," was the cover story of Sunday's New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of Dead Certain: The Presidency of George W. Bush.